Miss Margot Gore, Reel 4. Could you tell me about the training the women received at the ATU?
Well, I think the training program was really the key to the whole success of the ATA, both for the men and the women. I mean, there was no difference to it. And the credit to this, I think, goes to Captain Macmillan, who was the chief training officer of BOAC. He designed the method, which was really placing aircraft into different groups, Group 1, Group 2, Group 3, and Group 4. And each group also tended to be slightly subdivided in that when you got on to Group 3, you didn't fly all the aircraft within that group. It was left to the commanding officer to progress you from the easier ones to the more difficult ones. And then they were trained on a basic trainer such as the Harvard at White Waltham, which then prepared you to fly Spitfires, Hurricanes, and ultimately Tempests, and so on. And the Oxford, which prepared you for the twins, and then Blenheims, which slightly were operational twin-engine bombers. And then, of course, we had our conversion course at Marston Moor onto four engines. But it was this division of aircraft into groups which made us able to cope with all sorts of different kinds of aircraft. Then we had absolutely superb handling notes which were written at headquarters. They were white books which had every sort of information that you could require to know about the aircraft. So that when a pilot was given an aircraft that she hadn't flown before, in a category for which she was capable of flying, she then had to take from the library at the pool a handling note and a sign for it. And she had to read it and sign that she had read it. And she was not allowed to be given a chit, at least I didn't allow them to take a chit, until I had seen that they had signed their handling notes. Then we had our own individual handling notes, which were, we call it sort of aide-memoir. All the aircraft were listed with the essential pieces of information, the type of engine, whether they were supercharged, the undercarriage operation, the flap operation, the gills, the amount of petrol that they carried, the normal tanks, how you switched them over, how you started them, and so on. And then they would give you takeoff information, boost, RPM, mixture, gills, elevator, trim, and all the rest of it. The climbing, boost and revs, the ATA cruise and revs, slow flying, the stalling speeds, how the approach and landing, the effect of the flaps being put down, and so on. So you, if you forgot halfway through, you could pull your notes out and say, "Ah, yes, you mustn't put your flaps down until your speed has been reduced to so and so and so and so." And I don't think we had a very low accident rate in the ATA, and I don't think many of it was due to not understanding how the aircraft worked. It was an error of judgment or a moment of forgetfulness, but it was not the fault of our training. And I think that it was a supreme example of a man ahead of his time, knowing how to divide aircraft into different categories, and the pool CO then had to progress their pilots within those ranges. And it was very, very remarkable.
What was your state of mind when flying? How did you actually feel up in an aircraft?
You mean, was I frightened? Or
Yes.
sometimes, if the weather was bad. But I think that everybody who flew, or who'd done a lot of flying even before the war, there was something about getting into an aeroplane which divorced you from the problems of Earth. There was a wonderful freedom, which is very difficult to describe, and I've never had it since I stopped flying. And you didn't always have it, but just occasionally, perhaps if you'd been worried or something, and you got into an aeroplane, you took off and you climbed, say a Spitfire, and you climbed up to 6,000 feet, there was this marvellous release from the problems and pressures of the Earth, which I suppose perhaps climbers get it, perhaps going up Everest, you may get the same feeling. I don't know. But I believe a lot of my friends have told me they got the same feeling. It was very exciting also, flying a new type. And of course, you did frighten yourself of that, there's no doubt. You suddenly found that you were approaching too high or too fast or something, and you had to do something about it. And it made the adrenaline flow. And I think when you got down, you were then excited at having overcome a problem, a frightening problem, one that could have killed you.
What was the actual documentation the pilots carried?
We only carried a flight authorization card and our ordinary, whatever they called it, what did we use to carry, an identification card, and our handling notes. That's a lot. That's all there was to it. And we were permitted with our authorization card to make our own flight plans. I mean, we had the power to take off, unless there was some emergency flap going on the aerodrome, in which case they could ground you.
Like what?
Well, like an air raid about a pair or aircraft taking off on a bombing raid or something like that, in which case they had the power to close the aerodrome. But otherwise, we could authorise our own flights. They couldn't stop us within those parameters.
What did the women do when they weren't flying their sexual life?
Well, I think quite a lot of them had... I think a lot of us were very tired by the end of the day, and most of us used to go back and have a meal and fall into bed. You know, sometimes we had very, very heavy long days. A lot of them used to go out on quite a lot of parties. There were quite a lot of naval officers about, quite a lot of service people about. I think there was quite a good social life. I was always too jolly tired, having other responsibilities. We used to play squash. There was a squash court there. I had a boat, a sailing boat, moored in the river, and you had to have a fishing permit. In other words, it was a permit that the Navy could check who you were. And I used to go sailing on my off days. And sometimes a group of us would go over to the New Forest and hire horses and go for a ride. We all had a very good relationship. I mean, I can't think of anybody, not really, who didn't fit in. I think they all loved flying. They all wanted to be doing that, and this was the overriding emotion, really. A lot of them, of course, were married. Their husbands were in the services and abroad. There was always a rather anxious time for them if there'd been any operation going in that which their husbands were involved in. Some were taken prisoners. There were certain tensions, but I would say that we would have amazed a lot of people if you'd said that 50 women could have shared a mess and a job with so little friction or trouble. I mean, there may have been, but I certainly didn't hear of it.
and it wasn't apparent.
Do you think that a particular type of woman was attracted to flying, or perhaps a particular type was more suitable to flying than others?
No, I don't think so. I think if you'd been good at any athletics, if you played an instrument well, or if you sailed, or if you rode, you were likely to be a better pilot, because it was all coordination. A good gymnast, for example, would have good coordination. A lot of them had hunted or sailed or skied. They'd been sportswomen of some kind or other, the early ones. And I think this did make you a better pilot, or more suited to it. But as far as the type, they were all types. I don't think you could have put your finger down and said she would like to be a pilot. Not really. But they were a remarkable group of women, for which it really was a very great honour to try to lead them. They didn't have to be led. I mean, they wanted to be doing what they were doing. I don't think I can remember giving an order. I asked people, and they always did it, which is the ideal way. And I don't think I ever had to have anybody in and really dress them down. Not really. I might have perhaps said, I don't think this is a good idea, or, you know, don't do that again. But there was never had to shout anybody out.
Who found the accommodation for them?
Our adjutant, Margaret Murray, found as many rooms as she could, and then we posted people into them when they came, and then if they didn't like it or they wanted to do something different in their own time, their own way, they found something. Some people had flats. I had a cottage, which three of us shared. Right on the edge of the aerodrome. It wasn't easy, because there weren't all that number of houses. But we fitted them in somehow. Most of us had cars with a limited amount of petrol. Very limited amount of petrol.
You mentioned there'd been a food shortage. How did you all cope with that?
Well, during the invasion, we had to have quite a lot of tins of Spam and things like that, because what limited fresh meat there was. There wasn't room on the roads to bring stuff in. And, of course, we only had civilian rations. We didn't have service rations, because we were part of BOAC. We were civilians, in fact, not WAF or anything. So we didn't get military or Air Force rations. We had civilian rations. And it does remind me of a slightly funny episode when I'd taken an aircraft into Christchurch, which was an American squadron. And it was very bad weather, and I wasn't picked up by air. They were going to send a car because the clouds had come right down. So the commanding officer said, "Would I like lunch?" So I said, "Oh, yes, I'd like lunch very much." So I went into the mess, and they said, "Would you like a steak, you see?" So yes, love a steak. I hadn't seen a steak for about 4 years, not in whole piece. Anyway, the plate came, and it was a steak which I have never seen before or since. It was like a doormat. It was hanging over the edge of the plate. It was enormous. I think it must have been about half a pound of steak. And all the vegetables, you see. So, of course, I fell to with a will. And after about 4 mouthfuls, I couldn't eat any more. And they said to me, "Commander Gore, don't you like the steak?" So I said, "I love the steak." So I took my knife and I cut off 4 ounces or 2 ounces, whatever it was. 2 ounces, I think, we had a week of meat. And I said, "That's all I've had per week for 4 years." And I've never seen people look so shattered. They had no idea whatsoever, the Americans, what food we had, you see, because theirs was all flown over, all brought over. I mean, they had totally different rations to us. And they they said, but you look so well. So I said, well, you see, you don't really need all that meat. But thank you very much anyway. It was lovely what I had. Anyway, the car came for me. And as I was getting in, the CEO came out. He was a frightfully nice man with a brown paper parcel. And he said, this is for your pooch. Because I told him I had a dog. You see, I had a dachshund then. So I went away with this brown paper parcel. I may say the pooch didn't have it. He had the end of it. It made a meal for three of us, what was left. And beautiful steak, of course, absolutely lovely steak. And the pooch had the back end of it. But it did make you realize how little they understood of how we'd had to live. And we got, the only thing we got was a chocolate ration. That if you had a chit and you were going flying for the day, you got a bar of chocolate. You didn't get it unless you had a chit to fly. That's in case we got flying and perhaps couldn't get a meal at all, so we had a bit of chocolate. And in the canteen, we had virtually no meat. We nearly always had macaroni cheese or cauliflower cheese or baked beans or very, very Spartan food. But I don't think we suffered in any way. I think we were perfectly fit. In fact, I played squash regularly and sailed and walked.
So how long were you at Hamble together?
Until 1945, until August 45, from 41, wasn't it? I think I went down there in 41. No, 1940, June 1940, and I was there until 45. And then I was just went up to Whitehorse and just for the last couple of months, really to sort of hand things in and do a bit of flying, and then I left.
Who instructed you to go to Whitewater?
Headquarters. Pauline Gower was there.
Did you have any choice of
closing? No. I mean, it was. I mean, the whole thing was. We knew it was closing. I mean, we knew they were going to close in the October or something like that.
So, how many of you were posted there?
I think we all mostly all went there. It was really to hand in our equipment and finish up. And then I went back to London. And, you know, really what to do. Anyway, I went back to flying. I went back to instructing at White Waltham, which was the West London Aero Club. And I reconstituted my instructor's endorsement, but instead of having an assistant, I had a full one, because I'd done a lot more hours than 3,000 hours, something like that, by then. So I went back to flying, doing circuits and bumps, but my heart wasn't in it anymore. I'd had all the fun. I didn't want to go back to flying light aircraft again after flying Spitfires and Fortresses and Lancasters and Mosquitoes. And one of the senior commanders was a barrister at White Waltham. And I was telling him this and saying, I really don't want to go on doing this. And I, in a way, I wondered whether I'd go back and try to do a doctor's course. And of course, being a civilian, I didn't get any priority. The ex-servicemen got the vacancies at the hospitals, and I don't think I could have got a vacancy till about 1950 or 52 or something like that. And then 6 years on top of that, you see, and I was too old at that stage, I thought. So he said, well, why don't you consider being an osteopath? Because he was interested in the register of osteopaths. So I said, well, what's that? And he said, oh, well, go along and see the principal of the school. So I went along to Buckingham Gate, where the school was. And, of course, I had the higher schools and everything, but I hadn't done up-to-date physics, which was necessary for the entrance. So I went to a crammer's. I decided I'd do it, and I went to a crammer's and crammed myself for the entrance exam. And I did a 3 years course at the British School of Austere Obstetrics in 1950, qualified in 53, and I've only just stopped practicing. So I really got back into medicine in a sort of way after about 60 years, or 50 years. I've never regretted it, but I couldn't have gone on doing circuits and bumps. It was a dead end, really. After what we'd all had. So that's how I finished up. So I did a lot of flying, and had a great deal of fun, really. And to be an osteopath was a very fulfilling and satisfying profession. So that's really the end of my story.
Could you just tell me about the end of the war? Do you remember much about VE Day?
Well, I was at Hamble. I must have been. Yes, I do remember. The Queen Elizabeth came in. She hadn't been docking at Southampton during the war. She'd been coming into Greenock, I think, Scotland. And we all went down to the Southampton, where she came in. And she let off her great siren. You ever heard it go off, the Queen Mary or the Queen Elizabeth? Ground shook. This great... It was the most... I think it really did make you realise the war was over. And, of course, she looked absolutely beautiful. And then I think we did have a terrific party and all drank far too much that night. And that's about all I do remember of it. But I do remember the Queen Elizabeth came in. And then, of course, VJ Day was much later. That I don't remember at all. I think it was all rather an anticlimax, the end of the war. You know, you were ungeared too quickly. And nobody knew what they were going to do. Nobody knew what was in store for us. And then politically, of course, Churchill was thrown out, which horrified a lot of us. You know, he didn't deserve to be thrown out, although I don't think he was necessarily a very good civil prime minister. But he had seen us through the war, and we would have been sunk without him. And I thought it was always rather disgraceful that he was thrown out with such a bang. And then, of course, I started flying, going back flying again, so it... that's what I did for the next 3 or 4 years.
What effects do you think the war had on you personally?
I think that's awfully difficult to assess. I think it was a very frightening but a very exciting time, and I think perhaps from a woman's point of view it permitted you to do things that you would never ever have had a chance of doing otherwise. So perhaps it was you were excited, but of course one did feel a good deal of horror at what was happening if you were at all sensitive. Of course, we didn't know what was happening in Germany. We didn't know about the concentration camps until towards the end, when my brother actually was with the airborne division that opened Belsen. And he was never the same man again. It horrified him so. But of course we didn't see that. We did see the result of air raids, which were horrifying, but of course we didn't see what it was like in Germany, which was a million times worse. I think one was rather horrified at the destruction and the death, and then on the other hand rather excited too. You know, you knew you were doing something that was fairly worthwhile. And we had to do it. I mean, what would have happened to us if we hadn't fought? I don't know. And the mind boggles. We certainly would have sunk, I think.
Did you think the changes in society were positive?
Yes, one was, I think, slightly horrified at what did happen. I think the black market had undermined people's honesty. And I think as a society we were much less honest afterwards. And I think it all started because you did scrounge petrol and nylons and extra butter and so on. And I think it no longer was looked upon as dishonest to scrounge or nick or diddle the income tax inspector. And I think that was the beginning of it. And I think we're now perhaps seeing the full horror of people not having a sense of moral responsibility. And what is yours, and it's not for me to take. And I think it all started in the war.
In retrospect, how do you feel about your career in the ATA?
Oh, I think I was very lucky that I happened to have the hours and be in the right place at the right moment. And I don't think anybody could have had a more exciting and entertaining war, if you can use the word as entertaining, or as worthwhile. And it was just luck that I happened to be in the right place at the right moment with the right number of hours.
Do you think there was more pressure on you to be a perfect pilot because you were a woman?
Oh, yes. Certainly at the beginning, one had the feeling that you mustn't make a mistake. There was a pressure. Look, she's pranged that aircraft. Well, typical, of course, she's a woman. But that went, you know. That was only a very short period when you felt that you were under that sort of pressure. After a time, you knew you were doing it all right, and you knew that they couldn't criticise you.
Well, thank you very much.